welcome to the Shobha Narayan Show. This is my first podcast and I'm delighted to interview a guest visiting from Boston. Charlotte Clark has known me for 30 years and or 20 years, and we first met when I was a student at Mount Holyoke, and we've been in touch ever since. She is a bon vivant, a Renaissance woman, reads a lot, travels a great deal, and knows a lot, an awful lot of things about an awful lot of areas. Charlotte Clark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I want to ask you about music and art and literature and family, all the stuff that we care about. Let me start by asking, who is your favorite composer? Who are some of your favorite composers and some of your favorite music?
Well, I like two kinds of music. I like classical music, Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Mozart, and so on. I also like folk music. I used to be very, very fond of American folk music and old English folk music. A little bit of French, but mostly English and American. And I love, in fact, I love singing, and therefore I also love German Lieder, Schubert and Brahms and Hugo Wolf and all kinds of other 19th century stuff which is hardly ever heard anymore, but I still choose to listen to that when I'm alone.
Who is Hugo Wolf?
Poet.
Poet?
Yeah. Oh.
And he was...
I'm vague about that, but I'm quite sure he's a poet. Goethe and Hugo Wolf and other 19th century poets were often used by Schubert and Brahms. Brahms tended to write Lieder mostly with poets you'd never heard of. Even the Germans have never heard of him, or never had it, because he didn't want to compete with Schubert.
So for Charlotte, for somebody who's not familiar with Western classical music, does Mozart have a style? Does Brahms have a style? So
yeah, Mozart was in the early classical period. Beethoven came right after him. And sometimes if I'm hearing music on the radio and don't know who it is, I have a very hard time knowing whether it's Mozart or Beethoven. My husband immediately can... Well, we have a guessing game, and yeah, he usually wins. But sometimes it's hard to tell because their periods overlapped and their styles overlapped.
Yeah.
But not so Brahms.
Not so Brahms.
No, Brahms... Maybe Brahms was like a little bit of some Beethoven, but he was much more bombastic and... Beethoven could be bombastic too. It's hard to say.
What about Bach?
Well, Bach came first, and he was lovely. And he was, we listened to a lot of Bach. My husband hardly ever listens to the oratorios of Bach, which I love, because I like choral music. But at the moment he's into, as we say, Bach, the English suites and the French suites, which are harpsichord or piano, and he's listening. We have our recordings in the car, and he listens. If he wants to learn something, he keeps it in the car and just listens to it over and over and over and over again. Even if he's only going 10 or 15 miles, he gets a little snippet and has that in his brain. And so right now he's been doing the English suites and now the French suites, which are very simple, orderly, I call them geometric, pieces of music.
What about Russian composers? Do you listen to any of them?
Yeah, sometimes, but not with the same enthusiasm.
Not with the same enthusiasm. George had told me that there are some classical, iconic music that, like, I know the Moonlight Sonata, I know Four Elise. These are very rudimentary, right? What should I graduate to? What should I listen to?
Oh, I don't know. You just have to listen to a lot of things and discover which ones you like best. Yeah, it's really hard to say which one is better because they're all... It depends on your mood and your stage in life. And
it doesn't have things like ragas like we have in South Indian music.
You'll have to explain a raga to me because although I know the word, I could never tell anybody what it meant.
A raga is a set of notes that are sung with a certain mood so that you listen to, and each of them has a name. So we, just like do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, you have sa, re, ga, ma, pa, da, ni, sa. and they are arranged in a certain way. So some ragas have only five notes. So you have sa ga ma da ni sa. So that's like six notes. Mm-hmm. And the trick is to keep singing them in a certain way. And connoisseurs listen to a snippet and can identify the raga, just like what
right.
you said.
Mm-hmm.
And but the what my assumption is that Western classical is a harmonic form and Indian classical music is more linear in the sense that one person sings and it goes, whereas there's no orchestra, there's not an orchestra type thing that's happening in Indian classical music. So.
Oh, I'm afraid you're over my head.
Okay.
And that's why I don't know what a raga is, even though I've heard it. It's been described to me many times, and I can't even reproduce those six notes. I could if I worked at it very hard. I cannot, although I love Indian music. We used to have a chokidar who lived outside our gate, or inside the gate, I guess, when we were living in Pakistan. And he came from the Northwest Frontier, and he sang Pathan love songs all night long to keep himself awake.
Wow.
And it was a marvelous thing for me to go to sleep hearing these beautiful love songs. I never, ever could reproduce them.
Huh.
And I think maybe you have to be born to it.
Yeah. I think you have to be born. And I listen to something Indian and I can immediately remember it. But I'm listening to, as you said before, I'm listening to Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto.
But you can reproduce that.
It's very simple. It's very simple, yeah. Does an orchestra make a difference in the playing of a certain piece? So, for instance...
Oh, I'm sure they will tell you so. Yes,
yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean... Yeah, I mean, people will tell you that just getting a new conductor will change a whole orchestra.
So Seiji Osawa, are you familiar with him?
Yes, I am, because he was sort of a saint in
Boston
for many
yeah.
years. People didn't call him Seiji Osawa, they just called him Seiji.
Oh, Seiji,
yes,
okay.
Because they loved him so much that one word was enough. They didn't need to throw on the Osawa. But yes, he... I think he changed the tone of the orchestra. Koussevitzky was the man of my generation, and people called him Kusi, because I mean he was just he was so much loved in Boston. All these conductors.
Kurt Masur in New York.
Yes, and the conductor can make a huge difference.
Yeah, and this man.
It's like the chairman, the head of a football team. I mean.
Yeah, can make
yeah.
a difference. So, how did we meet, Charlotte?
Well, I remember vividly when we met. Not just because I've told the story over and over and over again.
To my kids, among others.
But I remember being at Mount Holyoke one January, and I was there for only 10 days maybe, a little seminar on how to learn how to use computers back in the late 80s?
It was 1987.
87, my heavens. So I went there for a little seminar to learn about computers. Didn't learn anything that I used today, but I felt more familiar afterwards. Anyway, I went into the breakfast room one morning in South Rockefeller, and there I saw, the sun was streaming in from the east, and I saw you across the room with what looked like a big black
halo.
Well, you looked like, you had a huge afro, your hair is very, very kinky.
Yes.
And you just washed it probably, it was just sort of standing out like a great big ball. And the sun was shining through it, and you were wearing a yellow sweater. And the combination of the yellow glints in your hair and the yellow yellow sweater made a marvelous picture. So I went around to look at your face, and at first I thought, oh, how nice, Mount Holyoke now has Africans as students. So I went around to look at your face and discovered you were not African, but very Indian. And we got talking about India, and you asked me if I had ever been to India, and I said yes. And then you said, well, if you ever go back, you must stay with my parents. And so I said, well, I'm not likely to go to India anytime soon, but you probably are going to come to Boston, so why don't you come and stay with us?
And
so
I
you did.
Did. And I did.
Yeah.
for months and months and months.
Yeah.
And then we went to Martha's Vineyard.
And you went sailing. And
yes.
I was fascinated because I had the idea that girls who wear saris could never get into a boat.
Yeah.
Because our boat is the kind where you get not just your feet wet, but you get everything wet in our boat. And you put on a bathing suit And no, I don't even think you even wore a life preserver.
No, I just jumped right in.
You're a good swimmer. Anyway, I have photographs of you, yeah, somewhere in our scrapbook. I do keep a scrapbook, and I have pictures. And then you got married.
Yes.
And I have pictures in that same book of you and Narayan covered with, festooned with flowers, I
right.
should say.
Charlotte, tell me about Martha's Vineyard, because it has such a special place in Americana. I mean, it's like the rich people's place.
Well, we are not the rich people, but we live as if we were rich. No, we don't. We don't live as if we're
rich. You live as if you're sophisticated.
Well, I don't know if we're sophisticated. We live like poor people in a rich place. My husband had this opportunity in the late 60s, to buy a piece of land that was, I think it was 60 acres.
You bought 60 acres?
He bought 60 acres for $75,000.
My word.
And he didn't have $75,000 because he was a mere professor, but he did have a small inheritance and some other little money that he had stashed away, and he was able to make a down payment and mortgage the property. And he still couldn't afford to have such a big, I mean, it was a big expense
yeah.
for him at that time. Nothing like what it would be today. I mean, today it would be out of the question. Nobody
yeah.
can buy that. But he took one piece of the land that was off to one side that we would never be using anyway, and built a road down it, and carved it up into lots, building lots, and sold them one by one. And every time he sold a lot, he could pay off a piece of the mortgage. And so that's how the mortgage got paid without his lifting a finger, basically. And we still own one of those lots as a kind of nest egg for in case there's a big tragedy or crisis in the family. We have
a lot.
Because you could always sell a building lot on Martha's Vineyard.
Absolutely.
But we have 40 acres left, and he tends those 40 acres lovingly. He's built paths through the woods, got Lyme disease a couple of times from being in the woods too much and not wiped. The ticks that make Lyme disease they're sort of secretive and almost invisible. They're the color of your skin. Until they get engorged with blood, and then you can see them.
Mm.
They're really skin-colored to begin with, and you just don't know that. They get into little places where you wouldn't look. All kinds of.
So you're how do you get to? I know this, but we drive the car into the ship, and then we drive.
We drive from our house down to Woods Hole. Woods
Hole
is about from Boston about 1.5 hours.
And the famous marine.
The marine laboratories at Woods Hole. Yeah.
Yes. One of Ranjini's friends wants to be a marine biologist.
Well, that's the place to go.
That's the place to go.
Yeah. So we go down to Woods Hole, we wait in line, and we always have, almost always, in the old days you didn't need a reservation, you just went and went standby.
Yeah.
And except on very busy weekends, that was not a problem. Now it is very much a problem. I always get a reservation in advance. And which means we're always in a rush to get down there. But now the tickets are electronic, so one big tension in our lives has been removed. We used to be halfway down and I'd say, oh, I forgot the tickets. But now if we just go down and give our name, it's like going on an airplane today. You just give them your passport and they already know who you are and what seat you're on.
And then the car comes as well.
Yeah, we take the car always. We always have had to because we used to have three dogs. And we always have an ice chest. We don't have the dogs anymore, but we still have the ice chest. And all kinds of other stuff we're always taking back and forth.
Mm.
It seems silly, but we...
And then is life at the vineyard different from your life in Boston?
Yes, very much, because, for one thing, George is one of these people who likes building all the time. When I first went there, we had a very simple little house with a tiny little kitchen and a big living room in terms of cubic footage, but not square footage. It's two stories high.
Mm.
And he wanted to build a circular house, a round house, but he found he couldn't do that because it's really hard as a carpenter to get round wood.
He built that whole house himself?
He built the whole house himself with his graduate students and his postdocs helping him.
My word.
And we have marvelous photographs. The next time you go, I'll show you the photographs of the house bit by bit. He built sort of an umbrella, and the house hangs down from the umbrella. The roof is the umbrella, top of the umbrella. There's a center pole, and the front of the umbrella is two stories high with windows looking out onto the We call it the pond. Well, it is a pond.
It is the pond.
It's named the Edgartown Great Pond, but it's the largest body of water in all of Massachusetts.
Right.
So it's a great view, and it's about less than 2 miles to the ocean, and you can, if there are no trees in the way, you can see from the balcony of the living room all the way out to the ocean.
And we've walked down the path into the water and just gotten into the boat and sailed.
Yeah. And we keep the boats right on the water's edge.
Yeah. And how did you and George meet? What Charlotte isn't saying is that her husband, George Clark, is an astrophysicist at MIT and one of the smartest people.
Of course.
Yes.
What is smart about him is that he still does programming, which hardly anybody does over the age of 60, let's say.
Right.
They all get a graduate student to do it for them. But my husband loves to do his own programming.
And what is his research? Astrophysicist, what is that?
Well, he looks at the stars, and he's very much interested in certain stars, and if he were here, he would be embarrassed by what I'm saying. But he looks at galaxies, which I think are in the Cloud of Magellan, which is sort of, it's part of the Milky Way.
Yes.
If you're in the Southern Hemisphere, you can look up and see the Clouds of Magellan. And if you had super, super vision, you could actually see the galaxies he's interested in.
Yeah.
And there's a satellite called Chandra, which which used to be called AXAF. Mm. AXAF was, it has to do with X-ray something or other, and that was George's baby. When I first came to live with him in the 80s, he was called Mr. AXAF by the people he knew, but that's now long in the past. But finally AXAF got built about 20 years after it was planned, and because of that it has its own name, which is now of course AXAF, and they named it after Chandrasekhar.
Oh.
Yep.
So it's called Chandra?
It's called the Chandra, or just they just call it Chandra.
Okay.
Yeah. and Chandra sends back messages all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
So when I went to first live with you, you had all these students that were hanging around. So there was Reiko from Japan, whose father, Mr. Oda, was an astrophysicist as well.
Among other things, yeah.
Among other things.
Well, he also was president of the university and...
Oh, so he was a biggie
in
Tokyo.
He was a very well-known man in Japan. And I think he was a national treasure. The family doesn't call him a national treasure, but I think he was... You know, the Japanese give prizes to people for being very special, and he was one of those rare...
So Reiko had come to Bangalore a few years ago, and she phoned me up because you gave her the number.
Yeah.
And she's now a scientist and traveling all over the world.
Well, she was here. I was in France with her mother looking after her children.
Yes, she married a Frenchman and is now.
Yeah.
And then you had Pratap, whose family you've known for longer than you've known me.
That's right, for longer than I was born. I mean, before I was born, I've known his family.
And you're going to Delhi for that wedding.
Yes.
So who is the person who is getting married?
The person who is getting married is actually not a blood relation of Pratap.
Yes.
He is the grandson of the second wife of Pratap's uncle.
Yeah, Sudarshan.
Yeah, Sudarshan is his uncle.
Sudarshan is married to Nahid.
Yep.
Who is the daughter?
And Nahid is the daughter of the Nawab of Rampur. And one of the daughters.
Mm.
He had quite a few children. And so in that family, it's a very big family, and they all get together for weddings and, I suppose, funerals and everything else.
And you've come for many of the weddings in that family.
One, only.
Only one.
Yeah.
That is...
Well, no, I came for Pratap's aunt. Madhu was married when I was living in Pakistan in the 60s. I came in October for... Delhi is very hot in October.
Mm.
And they had a wonderful wedding at the International Center, I think it was called, with rose petals. When they were made bride and man and wife, rose petals fell from the...
Yeah, from the heavens.
There was sort of a Greek temple. There were fountains playing, and they were standing in the light. It was quite beautiful, actually.
So tell me about your interest in art, Charlotte. You're a member of the Museum of Modern Art in Boston.
Fine Arts.
MFA, Museum of Fine Arts.
Fine Arts, yeah.
Yeah.
We have a modern art museum called the ICA, the
International Center of...
So
Which type of art do you like?
Well, I'm interested in modern art just because you have to be.
Yeah.
Because it's there and people I know are doing it. But I still gravitate toward the 18th century, really. I love 18th century art.
Wow, which is, I'm trying to think of the names.
You can think of all these wonderful old French and English paintings from that period of people with white silk knee breeches and red,
yes.
The men, that is, and red jackets or velvet jackets. They always wore velvet.
So the Impressionists were 19th century, so
yes.
18th would be Vermeer and...
Earlier than that. Okay. Well, maybe. No, Vermeer would have been. Yes, Vermeer might have been
17th.
Yes,
17th. That's the Dutch master.
Yes. 18th. I mean, I like all of those things. How can you help? I mean, I don't especially like Egyptian art.
No?
Hmm. I've never really liked, especially I don't like Egyptian architecture. And I think it's because I grew up in the days of, I was born in 1929. So the art in America at that time was influenced very much by Egyptian stylized art, very long straight lines, and I find it oppressive.
Hmm.
If you go to Egypt and you see, I don't know enough about it to tell you the names of them.
We went to Egypt and we saw.
There was one big building that was long and low and flat, with very horizontal lines. And it reminded me of art of the 1930s in New York, the Rockefeller Center period.
Mm.
And I was quite shocked to see that I was turned off by it, even in Egypt, where at least it was authentic.
Mm. Do you like very floral art, like Islamic art and Persia, all the calligraphy?
Well, I think of Islamic art as not being so floral as being geometric, and that's
geometric.
What I like about it.
You like it? Like
yes.
The Taj? Yeah, it is, of course, symmetrical.
And lots of triangles and squares. And I love Islamic art.
Yeah.
And I love the repetitiveness of it. That I liked in Egypt.
Mm.
But the pre-Islamic art in Egypt, of course, it was fascinating, and I took thousands of photographs. Which we never look at.
Yeah, I know.
But they're all
beautiful. I don't know why we all take photographs.
But the sky was blue and the buildings were yellow and the contrasts were great. And
yes.
You just had to take all these pictures. And George at the time could tell me what I was taking pictures of. I didn't bother to write anything down because he knew.
Yeah.
But I have no idea what I took pictures of now. It's just...
You told me something that I never forgot since, because you've spent time in Japan. You said the most sensuous part of a woman in Japan is her...
The back of her neck.
The back of her neck.
Yeah.
And I use it in my writing, I think about it, and Japan is a place you know quite well, I think.
Well, I used to. I haven't been there for a while.
Yeah. But I went there recently, and it's a fascinating culture.
It is.
It is very, very formal, and they have an aesthetic sense that is remarkable. Their attention to detail, their ability to take everything to the... I met an American there called Alex Kerr, who lives in Japan and runs workshops for visitors on... It's like Japanese Art 101, Japanese
mm-hmm.
calligraphy. And he said the reason Japanese art is so refined is because it was at the end of the Oriental chain. So the art that originated in China moved to Korea and ended up in Japan, and by the time it reached Japan, it had been refined and refined and refined. So if...
That's lovely. I thought of that.
Yeah,
it's
true. It's the way, I mean, if you think of anything, any type of art in Japan, it originated in China. Pottery, the Chinese have pottery. Calligraphy, the Chinese have... In fact, the script is the same, but it's been refined to the nth degree. Japanese are very good at taking an idea and making it the best possible.
Well, then you can go into religion and think of Buddha, who began in India.
Yes.
And went all the way as far as Japan. Is that the same thing, that it gets more and more refined by the time it gets to Japan?
And India is... India has lots of things, but it's hardly refined in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
We don't... Our art is very... we have a lot of it, like at the crafts fair that we visited. I mean, there's so much stuff, but I don't think refinement is a quality that Indians cultivate. Maybe I'm wrong, but...
And I don't know why the Japanese have such attention to detail. They love it.
Yeah. And a geisha I visited, I left my shoes outside, and then somebody just runs right behind me and sets it.
Oh yes, you did it wrong.
Yeah.
They didn't tell you you did it wrong. But
yeah,
you saw
they just did it.
They had to be this way, not that way. Yeah. Yes.
It was just a little bit all right, but they fixed it. And it's just they couldn't bear it any other way. Yeah. So.
Yeah, they're very careful not to criticize you.
Mm.
When I first went to Japan, it was the summertime, and I observed that people took off their shoes as they came in the door of the house, so I, of course, took off my shoes, and I went barefoot. And then I wanted to go out into the garden, which was the other end of the house, the other door. And they didn't go out in their bare feet into the garden. They had slippers outside the back door, which they put on. But of course, I didn't have slippers, and my feet are twice as big as any Japanese woman's feet. So anyway, they scurried around and got some slippers for me to wear in the garden.
Are you fascinated by Russia as I am, or not really?
Russia is a very big subject.
Yeah.
And I've been there only once, and
so have I.
And it was hot summer, and I finally got sick while I was there. I got some horrible bronchial infection.
But they have so much art, and their national, I don't know, there's a little pathos in their soul, I find. I mean, the chess playing and the literature. The Russians have an intuitive understanding of sadness, I think.
Yeah, and we didn't see any of that when we were there with the astrophysicist.
Of course, you were talking, you were in the stars.
The first thing we did when we went to Russia was, we went to St. Petersburg, because my brother was posted with the U.S. Embassy there, and we spent 4 days with him just wandering around. And St. Petersburg is marvelous. Mm. I mean, it really is. And we got to go inside the Hermitage, and we... But that's not Russian art. Mm. That's all European art. And we went to see the observatory, of course, because for two reasons. One is that George is an astronomer, and the other reason is that George's grandfather's cousin was a maker of lenses for telescopes.
Oh.
And the Polkova Observatory has one of his lenses, which he made back in the 1840s or 50s or 1870s maybe.
Yeah.
So we had, and Polkova is right next to St. Petersburg, where they had a big siege during the war.
Mm.
And battle, I've forgotten how many years they were besieged. It was a terrible, terrible time.
Mm.
And they protected that lens for the telescope by burying it underground, and it survived the war.
Mm.
So they had it up again and running, and we got to go see it and sort of.
Which country or culture or cultures are you fascinated by, Charlotte? There's European. I mean, France is a big one for all the.
I grew up as an Anglophile.
Mm.
As a child, I was very Anglophilic. As a little girl, I remember when the war began, praying every night that the war would end. Not so that those people wouldn't be embattled anymore, but so that I could go to England. I'm still an Anglophile, although England has changed a lot since the first time I saw it. And of course I love France, and grew up loving France because my mother was a great Francophile. And
what was your maiden name?
Huston, H-U-S-T-O-N, but pronounced Huston.
Mm.
Everybody else pronounces it Houston, but we pronounce it Huston.
Huston, yeah. Charlotte Huston. Yeah, France, and then Middle East, not so much. Your daughter lives in Dubai.
She lives in Dubai, but she doesn't know a word of Arabic.
Mm.
And I found that shocking when I was just there.
Mm.
And we were drinking coffee, and I wanted to say cheers, or I wanted to say something before we all picked up our cups and began drinking.
Mm.
And I said, how do you say that in Arabic? And nobody knew, except there were two women who were Saudi Arabian women in our group. We were taking a yoga class together.
Mm.
And there were two Saudis there, and they explained to me that how you say, not Sahel, I have it written down somewhere.
Salam?
No.
Not Salam.
No, wait. I have it written right in this little piece of paper. Saha.
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 Okay.
That's what you say before you have a drink.
Yes. Okay. And of course, you India and Asia, some parts of Pakistan, you've seen.
So Sybil lives in Dubai and she doesn't know any Arabs because the Emiratis keep to themselves. She teaches at the American school, which is not just for American kids, there are all kinds of children there. And one of her closest friends for many years, until last year when she tragically died, was a very nice Indian woman from Kerala and Bombay, mostly from Bombay, I mean, currently from Bombay, whose name was Sudha, and whose sister's name was Soba.
Mm.
And Sudha and Soba and I went together to a meeting in Greece with Sybil, and the four of us went to, we'd had a long drive through the mountains of Greece together.
How nice.
Yeah. And then she got this weird, strange illness and died.
Oh.
Leaving two children the ages of yours.
Oh, no.
It was terrible. And her current best friend is a Nigerian woman who went to the tennis match with us.
Mm.
So Dubai is a very international place. I went to a lunch party for a New Zealand girl who was getting married, and her friends all got together and gave her a whole day of activities, including going down to Abu Dhabi to race cars on a racetrack. And
oh, how nice.
Yeah, crazy things. And we didn't do that.
We
went home and had a siesta in the afternoon.
Yes.
All these girls were in their 20s.
Yes.
But most of them were English. The bride is New Zealander, and there were one or two other, I think they were all English except the bride.
Mm.
And mostly they were writers.
Mm.
And someday you'll get to know some of those
people. Yeah, if I go visit Sybil.
Shall
we check if it's come out?
Yes, let's see what it is. Then you can cut and paste.
Yeah, cut and paste. Let me see.